I wanted to talk a little bit about virtue. But as I started looking into it, I started realizing that the word has an incredible amount of meanings. In Webster's dictionary, there is 10 different definitions. But when you come to Webster's 9th dictionary, there's only 5. And this has them more in the order of what we're used to, because the word has changed since Webster originally did the dictionary. So I'm going to read some of this. Virtue, 1A, conformity to a standard of right, or morality, a particular moral excellence. That's the first meaning. And that's what we normally think of. But then it goes on with some other meanings. As in plural form, an order of angels in the celestial hierarchy. 3, a beneficial quality or power of a thing. 4, manly strength or courage, valor. 5, a commendable quality or trait, merit. 6, a capacity to act, potency. 7, chastity. So I guess I was wrong. I thought there was 5. There was 7 in this dictionary. But I would like to go through and read the definition from a dictionary that was a little older, around the time when the King James Bible would have been written. It'll give us a little light on what some of those verses mean. Because the first definition of virtue in Webster's dictionary is strength. That substance or quality of physical bodies by which they act and produce effects on other bodies. In this literal and proper sense, we speak of the virtue or virtues of plants in medicine, the virtues of drugs in decoctions. The virtues of plants are extracted. By long standing in the open air, the virtues are lost. And this is the primary definition several hundred years ago. So we see that the meaning of the word has changed a little bit to the way we normally use it today. We have to come down. And then the second definition is bravery or valor. This was the predominant signification of virtue among the Romans, which would have been the time when the Bible was written. And we see that definition used in the Bible. But even at this time, it says that this sense is nearly or quite obsolete. And then we have to come to the third meaning before we come to what is now the first meaning. Moral goodness. The practice of moral duties and the abstaining from vice, or a conformity of life and conversion to moral law. In this sense, virtue may be, and in many instances, must be distinguished from religion. The practice of moral duties merely from motives of convenience or from compulsion or from regard to reputation is virtue as distinct from religion. The practice of moral duties from sincere love to God and His laws is virtue and religion. In this sense, it is true that virtue only makes our bliss below. 4. A particular moral excellence, as the virtue of temperance, chastity, or charity. 5. Acting power, something efficacious. And this, we have a usage of this in Mark chapter 3, when Jesus, knowing that virtue had gone out of him. And 6, secret agency, efficacy without visible or material action. 7 is excellence, or that which constitutes value and merit. 8, one of the orders of the celestial hierarchy. 9, efficacy or power. 10, legal efficacy or power, authority. A man administers the laws by virtue of a commission. So, the title of my sermon, what I want to speak on, is something that I have termed the backup virtue. And so I'm going to speak of virtue as in the common sense of the usage of the word, what we normally think of, a particular moral excellence. But to balance this out a little bit, I'm going to go to 2 Peter and show you a usage of the word that is slightly different from that meaning. If I can find Peter here. Second Peter, the first chapter in verse 5. And beside this, giving all diligence, add to your faith virtue, and to virtue knowledge, and to knowledge temperance, and to temperance patience, and to patience godliness, and to godliness brotherly kindness, and to brotherly kindness charity. My purpose for turning here is because this usage of the word is different from the usage that I'm going to primarily be using it today. And so I don't want this verse to confuse you, because I'm going to speak. And here in this verse we have, add to your faith virtue, to virtue knowledge, and to knowledge temperance. And temperance is going to be the primary subject of my message. And in this verse we have virtue coming long before temperance. And I'm going to be speaking of virtue primarily coming after temperance, because we're speaking of different meanings of the word virtue. If we look at the word that this word virtue in 2 Peter 1:5 was translated from, it becomes pretty clear that that goes along with the second definition of virtue as valor. And Adam Clark defines that word in 2 Peter very well when he said, courage or fortitude. So, to restate myself, according to the use of the word virtue in Peter, as he used it for courage or fortitude, it is the one of the preliminary things to temperance. But according to the common definition of the word virtue, as a particular moral excellence of charity or some other thing, what I am going to attempt to establish this morning is that self-control or temperance is the backup virtue of all other virtues. Because as we go on, and I hope to touch on this a little bit more in a few minutes, even in the same passage, Peter has patience, godliness, brotherly kindness, and charity all come after self-control. And those are the sort of things that we usually think of when we think of virtue. So, I'm going to go on further to establish the things that I've just stated to you. And I'm going to start, I guess the next point that I want to make is, I've heard a lot of preachers using temperance and self-control interchangeably. So when I wanted to look into this, I thought I'd better double check and make sure. And what I found is it is very proper to do so. Because the word temperance gets all fogged up in our minds because we think of the temperance movement, where they taught that temperance meant abstinence from alcohol. But the definition of temperance is moderation, particularly habitual moderation in regard to the indulgences of the natural appetites and passions. Restrained or moderate indulgence, as temperance in eating and drinking, temperance in the indulgence of joy or mirth, temperance in eating and drinking as opposed to gluttony and drunkenness, and in other indulgences to excess. 2. Patience, calmness, sedateness, moderation of passion. So that's the definition of the English word temperance. But the definition of the Greek word that is translated temperance is self-control. Especially continence. So that doesn't make temperance a bad translation, but maybe a weak translation. So all I'm going to do is establish the fact that it is good and proper to use them interchangeably when you're speaking of those passages. So, my purpose in talking about this subject is this is a subject that has been very helpful and beneficent for me. Many times, I've been on the edge of vice. And this very subject has been a very great encouragement to me. And just in the past few weeks, I was able to counsel a young lady and found that this subject was very... And she found this subject very beneficial for her. And so when thinking about it, I thought I would put it together into a sermon form and share it with you guys. So I've established a little bit on the subject of what virtue is and on the subject of self-control. And now I'm going to show the relation between self-control and the other virtues. So hopefully I can get a little less boring than talking about dictionary terms and such and get into a little bit of the substance of these things. Because one of the most important doctrines for Christians to understand is progressive sanctification. Not every Christian needs to know what the term is and know how all the terms and ins and outs of doctrine work. But whether you or not you know this term, it's very important that you understand this concept. Because I've seen many people who see one fault in their life and begin to doubt their salvation, go into deep bondage, and all kinds of problems because they don't understand this concept of progressive sanctification. So I'm going to read this passage in 2 Peter once again. And beside this, giving all diligence, add to your faith virtue, and to virtue knowledge, and to knowledge temperance, and to temperance patience, and to patience godliness, and to godliness brotherly kindness, and to brotherly kindness charity. And if we just take this at face value and accept it for what it says, it tells us right out that there might be a time in a Christian's life that he has temperance, self-control, but he doesn't have patience. Now, what do you think a patient, what do you think someone that has self-control but does not have patience is going to act? What I'm going to propose to you is that man might act patient sometimes when he's not actually patient. This is the dilemma that I'm here to talk about. We have all experienced it. We have all experienced a situation where you don't feel a certain way, but you act right anyway. You don't want to do right, but you do right anyway. And here Peter lays it out very clearly. Add to your faith virtue, virtue, knowledge, knowledge, self-control, and to self-control, patience. And how about godliness? Is there going to be a time in your life where a particular situation arises in which you don't feel like doing the godly thing, but by self-control, you do it anyway? Or how about kindness? Maybe sometime you're not going to feel like being kind to somebody, but by self-control, you do it anyway. And here, the last two things, charity comes after kindness. How can it be? How can it be that someone can be kind without being loving? Is it possible? And you're going to have hyper-spiritual people tell you that such kindness is not kindness. But they're wrong. Here we have it laid out to us that sometimes kindness comes before charity. And it's on this foundation of self-control. And to the subject of progressive sanctification, a tree is either dead or alive. But not all trees are full size. And that is the root concept of progressive sanctification. A Christian is either sanctified or he is not. But not all Christians, and in fact, none of us, have attained to the fullness of the stature of Christ, to which we are pressing on. You are sanctified, and you are becoming more sanctified. The truth is you are sanctified, but the reality is you are becoming sanctified. And I have another question to throw out here. Is a victory that is not complete a defeat? This is the idea that a lot of people want to come to. Some people seem to think that if they are not perfect, they are living a defeated life. But think about it. David never lost a battle with the Philistines, as far as I can remember. Yet he never annihilated them either. Did David live in victory or defeat over the Philistines? Victory. Of course. And throughout the nation of Israel, many times, there was people around them, some of which they were told to annihilate, and they didn't annihilate. Yet the good kings lived in complete victory over them, though they were not fully annihilated. And that is exactly the concept that I am trying to lay out to you guys, is that there can be things in your life that you are living in victory over, even if they're not fully annihilated. It's not the end goal. The children of Israel were told to annihilate those people. It was their responsibility. But yet, David, even if they weren't annihilated, lived in victory over them. So many of the vices that Christians fight with are the same way, and I'm going to just quickly cover some of these vices. I'm going to start with pride. Jesus says in Luke 14:8, "When thou art bidden of any man to a wedding, sit not down in the highest room, lest a more honorable man than thou be bidden of him. And he that bade thee and him come and say to thee, give this man place, and thou begin with shame to take the lowest room. But when thou art bidden, go and sit down in the lowest room, that when he that bade thee cometh, he may say unto thee, friend, go up higher. Then shalt thou have worship in the presence of them that sit at meat with thee. For whosoever exalteth himself shall be abased, and he that humbleth himself shall be exalted." Timothy was just talking about this. You may find yourself at a wedding and every part of you says, "I deserve this seat." Every feeling in your heart tells you that. Yet if you think of this verse, think of what Jesus said and make the decision to take the lowest room anyway. Was that a defeat or a victory? The pride in you told you you deserved the high place. But the self-control, considering the words of Jesus, took the lowest seat. Some hyper-spiritual people would tell you, and we often end up telling ourselves that that is just a defeat. It's pride. We were defeated. It's very true that that pride needs to be dealt with. But still, that was an instance of victory, where you had victory over that very pride. And this is one in particular that I deal with. I find myself thinking about situations that I'm in, responsibilities that have been given me, And sometimes I begin to think about how good of a person I must be. But I know it's not true. But yet, my proud heart tells me so. And then I have to sit there and I remember that I'm just dust. I remember that I'm a broken earthen vessel and He is the treasure inside. And once again, is that a defeat or a victory? Sure, it's true that it points out to me that I have a lot of room to grow. Just if a thought possibly could enter my mind. But still, it's a victory. Because by God's grace, He helped me to overcome that pride. Lust. If you're driving down the road and you see a billboard that is lustful and you're tempted to look again, but if by self-control you refuse, was that a victory or a defeat? And again, it's the same answer. It tells you that you have a lot of room to grow. You have some struggles to deal with, but yet that particular situation was a victory. And you know the importance of understanding the way this works? There's two things. If we look at that situation as a defeat, we're either going to get discouraged and quit trying, or we are going to convince ourselves eventually that such feelings are not wrong. Both of which options are horrifying. We have to draw the line where it is, or we are in great danger of error. We have to draw the line exactly down the middle and understand the part of us that was defeated and the part of us that was victory. We have to, lest we fall into great danger. And anger is a good one. This one is actually the one that I've heard the most hyper-spiritual teachings on. Ephesians 4:26 tells us to be angry and sin not. Let not the sun go down upon your wrath. I've even heard people say that this was mistranslated. And I don't know Greek enough to go into it. I've already given way too many word definitions for what I like in a sermon. But this is my question. Is it possible to be angry and not sin? Well, let's ask the question a different way. Is it probable that being angry would make you sin? Yes, in fact, it's very probable. Be angry and sin not. This does not tell us that anger is not sin. What this tells us is stop your anger before you sin. Anger leads to the next sin. Anger leads you to punch someone. Anger leads you to smash something. Anger leads you to sin. And He says, be angry and sin not. Let not the sun go down upon your wrath. So, leaving aside whether this was mistranslated, leaving aside whether it's possible to be angry, leaving aside whether this is a command in which it's sometimes right to be angry or not, leaving all that aside, we can still deal with what we know that it's telling us. Because it implies that whether your anger is sin or not, it will cause you to sin if left alone. Therefore, even if it is not the fullest victory possible, stopping anger before it develops into a worse sin is still virtuous. And that's what I'm teaching today. This is the victory of self-control. I'm not telling you to not worry about going farther than this. All I'm telling you is that if you are at this state, if you are in the place where the anger rises up in your heart, take courage. Let your self-control. Let the Spirit guide you. Yield to the Spirit. And not your anger. And understand that even if it's not an absolute victory, it still is a victory. And if you do this, it makes you one step closer to the fullness of the stature of Christ. Stubbornness. I'm a supervisor myself at work. So I don't have as many times that somebody over me is telling me what to do, but it still does happen. And there's still times at which someone, a superior of mine, tells me what to do, and something inside me rises up and says, I refuse. And what am I to do in this situation? Something says, no, you're wrong. This is the way to do that. That's not the best way. This is the best way. But then the Spirit working inside of me begins to soften my heart. And if I've had enough self-control to keep from speaking for a few minutes, the first words out of my mouth will be, yes. I'll be right there. We've all experienced this, I'm sure. Face it, was that a defeat or a victory? Once again, it's the same answer. It points to you very directly that you have a place in which you need to grow spiritually. But still, it was a victory. Self-control is a fruit of the Spirit that we see in Galatians 5:22. Hatred. Now this one gets right down there to the quick. Some say that love is way more than a choice. Other people try to tell us that love simply is a choice. Just choose to love someone. I haven't had a man tell me that getting married should be easy. Just find a girl that's a nice girl and choose to love her. And I wasn't so sure about that. I decided not to take his advice. Most of us would at least go so far as to say that with romance, there has to be something more than a choice. But still we end up trying to say that with other kinds of love, it's just simply a choice. But love is more than a choice. There is something far deeper, far beyond simply making a choice. There are feelings that you could never choose to feel. There are actions that are beyond what you could just choose to do. Things you would never think of doing, unless you actually love the person. But if you don't love somebody, choose to. And it still is victory. If you're married, choosing to love your spouse is probably the best choice you could ever make. I hope there's more than that, but if that's all you have, it's better than nothing. If you're having a hard time loving someone, it's time to kick self-control into gear and make that choice to love. Galatians 5:22. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. Against such there is no law. This ability to control yourself against the very feelings of your heart is a fruit of the Spirit. And as I've already mentioned a couple times, it's not the end goal. If this is where you are, it tells you very clearly that you have a grand way to grow. But don't fall into the slough of despond and believe that you're living in absolute defeat. Because if you have that ability of self-control, even that is a fruit of the Spirit. Build off of that. Use that as the foundation to lay the other stones. And you say, well, but Israel, I'm not convinced. Even an unsaved man can have a bit of self-control. And that's not the fruit of the Spirit. But let's check the other fruits of the Spirit. Does an unsaved man still love his kids? Love is one of the fruits of the Spirit. Yeah, he does. Some worldlings can be quite joyful. Joy is one of the fruits of the Spirit. The devil gives some people false peace that's actually pretty peaceful for a time. And peace is one of the fruits of the Spirit. Some people can be long-suffering, at least in certain circumstances. And long-suffering is one of the fruits of the Spirit. Many, if not most, mothers are at least gentle with their children. And gentleness is one of the fruits of the Spirit. Unsaved sinners on their way to hell can sometimes be good, upright people. And goodness is one of the fruits of the Spirit. Lots of people have faith in lots of things. And faith is one of the fruits of the Spirit. And when it comes to meekness, some people were just born meek. And some people can learn to control themselves. Self-control is one of the fruits of the Spirit. So I lay this at the end. In case you're having questions and saying, oh, well, self-control is just me. There's no Spirit involved with it. Well, if that's the case, then if that's the case with you in particular, this sermon wasn't intended for you. Because people can fake all of these fruits of the Spirit. It may be even true that self-control is the easiest to do out of your own flesh. But all of them can be. But still, generally speaking, self-control is a fruit of the Spirit. One more thing to throw in here. You remember that love is the fulfilling of the law? Because why? Is it not true that if you properly loved, you would do everything right automatically? Anybody want to argue with that? Good. Why then do we need self-control? If love would cause us to do everything automatically right, why is self-control even a fruit of the Spirit? Sometimes we don't love properly, that's why. And we need a backup virtue. It's similar to another thing that the Bible teaches more clearly. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and perfect love casts out all fear. So we start by fearing God, but by the time we're finished, that very fear that we started with gets replaced by love. Sometimes in our Christian lives, we start with self-control. But by the time we're finished, that very self-control that we started with is replaced by love. So, don't despise the day of small things. The more we love, the less occasion we will have to exercise the fruit of the Spirit. So I guess my encouragement to you today is if you're at that place where love is not complete, don't hesitate to fall back on self-control and do what is right against every feeling of your own heart. And remember that that still is victory. So I'm going to close where I started. I've gone all around. I've established a little foundation of what virtue is. I've established a little foundation of what self-control is. And I've showed how self-control and virtue, how they tie together, and how self-control can often be the foundation for all other virtues. Which leaves me with a closing statement. Self-control is the backup virtue of all other virtues. Let's pray. Father, I pray that you would help us take your scripture to heart and live by it. Pray that you would let these things speak to us and encourage us as we go about in our lives. I don't know what each person might be struggling with, but I pray that by your Spirit you would take the words that you've spoken in your book and send them deep into each heart here. That each person would be encouraged to go on the next step in their Christian life. Amen. And let's dismiss.